I've never met Mr. Soros. I seriously doubt that I will ever meet Mr. Soros. But meeting with them has just reinforced he has become a boogeyman for the right that is really undeserved in a lot of ways.
On the last episode of part one of the Blue Grit podcast.
And seeing victims, sitting down with victims the next day and their families, really understanding what the whole component, every component of the picture looks like. You've got to have an open line of communication. And that's really all I'm going to promise. We're going to talk. We're going to be wide open. And you're going to know where I'm coming from. And more importantly, why I'm coming from that position every time. And regardless of whether we agree or not, we're still going to be able to go have a beer afterwards and talk about it.
I got to give you some kudos because you up my eyes to something.
It's the hair.
He's a pretty man. You know, I started in police work a long time ago, and so I'm told I'm old school and all of that. And through the years, as diversion and things like that came around, the term among cops is the hug a thug. And
I know,
you know, we'll send them somewhere in a beautiful facility for a couple of months. And I've always kind of had an opinion of that. But listening to one of your recent talks, talking about one of your ideas for diversion is making them go find a trade. Micro, we were talking offline, Micro is big on not everyone's child in America can be a CEO. Somebody is going to have to be a plumber, an electrician, HVAC. I like the idea of we're not going to send you to a beautiful campus facility,
exactly,
you know, for 2 months and then you're free and clear. You didn't do anything wrong. I like go out and figure out how to sustain your family. Because the funny thing is nobody wants to do those jobs anymore. My neighbor's son's like 24 or 25 years old in the HVAC business and is making a butt ton of money.
They're killing it. And when you think about it, and it's opened my eyes in the last year, really kind of thinking through this process, the benefits all the way down the line, right? When I put somebody on a diversion program that, you know, it's just all make us pat ourselves on the back and feel like we're doing good stuff and, you know, do 30 hours community service and we'll see you in a year.
And you're healed.
It ain't exactly. Go forth and sin no more. Like, it doesn't happen.
Right.
But if I say, here are your two opportunities, right? You're either going to be a plumber or an electrician or a seafarer or something else,
or
right?
Or a prisoner.
And you go, then during that year, I don't have to pay for supervision. They've got the infrastructure already built up, mm-hmm. right? And this isn't a also go find a job while you're on bond for whatever the case is. You're going to earn money while you're an apprentice in this program. And then if in a year that journeyman comes back and is like, this guy's on the road to recover. What do I get out?
And possibly set his family up to succeed and sustain and
generation.
Make a better constituent.
On that note, Sean, how are you going to address it with the actual, how are you going to finance that? That's a huge issue, obviously, with the county, because, I mean, Kilmaugh's excuse forever has been, I can't get any money from the commissioner's court. I can't hire any DAs. It's always been someone else's excuse or someone else's problem. Yep. And before you answer that, but clarify me, how many attorneys are we missing compared to what we were previously? Because, I mean, how could it work before and then all of a sudden it not work? So just any idea? Do you have any number on that? Just
curious. I mean, it's a moving target.
Okay.
The dirty secret that, as you said, it's never the current DA's fault. There are more DAs now than there have ever been.
Wow.
And the biggest backlog we've ever had.
Correct.
So no joke. Well, I'm glad you brought that to light.
It is running the office the right way. You know, look, our commissioner's court gets a bad rap, and a lot of it is unearned. They have increased her budget and the number of prosecutor spots every single year since 2017. Every year. They gave 22 spots 2 years ago on a dime. When we got three new courts, they fully staffed those three new courts with three prosecutors each last year. They're going to do it again next year. So we got more prosecutors than we've ever had. What you're seeing is a complete breakdown in the intake system, a complete breakdown in the ability, because of the continuity of one prosecutor to the next, in handling cases. And it's all based around paralysis and fear of doing your job so you get on the radar. Can't happen. That's why I keep saying you've got to empower the prosecutors. You've got to give them their discretion and let them go.
Yep.
Because that's the only way you get through the backlog and you see things start to work. But you had another great question that I forgot because I got onto that.
The how would you fund the...
Oh, yeah.
Yes, the funding, the diversion programs.
This is the beautiful part about it, especially when you're talking about the trades. You know how much it costs us to supervise somebody for a year on a pretrial diversion? Thousands of dollars. Mm-hmm. You know how much it would cost us to require somebody to go to a trade for a year and then come back and check in?
They've what's already the consequences got it built if the, what's the consequences if they don't?
Man, the case is picked right back up and we prosecute them. That's any diversion, right? They sign the tolling agreement. It's not dismissed.
How is it? Is it state funded, I guess?
No, they fund it. They want the trade unions need apprentices. Yeah. They want these apprentices. They pay out of the money that they make while they're working to become a member of the union. Mm. It's fully self-funded.
Sean, on that, so going back to the diversion program, because we do have a lot of people that are in diversion program that broke the diversion program and were not prosecuted. So you're telling me right here, right here on this podcast, that you're not going to do that.
So it depends on what the program is.
Okay. Right?
And it depends on what the violation.
If you don't mind.
So the DWI pretrial intervention programs,
okay.
that's the biggest one. You know, I think that you all know my history through the office and the fact that I think that is the most selfish, dangerous crime that most people will ever commit.
Yep.
Right. Get behind the wheel after you've had something to drink and it just.
Especially with Uber, Lyft, everything there is.
It's so selfish and stupid, but regardless. So those are going to be monitored and that's something we got to pay for. Right. I mean, that is something that's not going to go into a union, although it could. It's just typically those are pretty well tailored toward that. We are not revoking those PTIs in the manner that I think we should, right? I mean, you pick up another DWI, you violate a couple of lapses in drinking. You're not a candidate in my mind.
What about them being on diversion program and committing another theft at that point, say theft or something to that effect? I mean, you say they went from this from a simple possession.
Mm-hmm.
They're on the diversion program. Then while they're out on the diversion program, they're caught doing this. What's the recourse for that?
So for me, I think, again, you look at different things. If we're talking about addiction, right, for just simple possession, and you pick up a new PCS, that's something that maybe we do have some grace, right? Maybe you continue on. I really, really, really am of the opinion that when you start violating someone else, when you start affecting someone else's well-being, I really stop having a lot of grace for you. I simple possession on top of simple possession. All right, maybe we can still salvage that person, but when you start violating someone else, that's when I think job comes into play, right? Be it BMV, be it Berg Building, be it Berg Hab, certainly Ag Rob, you know, any sex crimes. Now, I get that you probably are a broken person and wounded, but now I got to come in. And so I think that's kind of where I land on what a diversion and potentially a continued successful diversion looks like.
Yeah.
As opposed to somebody who's on a low level diversion, but now commits a crime against someone else. Well, now I'm going to,
you know, you hit a little bit on that. Cause I know back in August when we met, you stated and so forth that if you're a threat to the community, flight risk, you will stay in custody.
That's it. And now we're moving into bond, which, you know, we should just tee up another hour. Sure. Here, right?
Yeah. So we could go on and on for this.
Look,
but you got to understand what we're dealing with. And the questions that need to be answered in Harris County are endless because we have been beat down
I know.
For so long.
I know.
Guys want
answers.
That's it.
So, well, it feels like it's a headline every week.
Yeah.
So-and-so out of jail commits murder. So-and-so out of jail robs family.
And what you've seen is just like we've talked about, the current DA does not accept responsibility for anything. I mean, you guys know the Texas Constitution, 11B, right? There are three ways.
Glad you brought that up.
To go about holding someone in custody unless they're charged with capital murder, or they are, and you're going to have a proof evident where you're going to seek death, or they're true habitual and commit certain enumerated crimes. Other than that, Texas Constitution says that person is entitled to a bond, mm-hmm. period. And that in no way does it make a provision if it's their 10th or 11th or 12th crime, right?
It also didn't say cashless, does it?
No, it doesn't. But what I'm saying to you is there's no way that the judge by themselves, regardless of how many times they've gotten out, can give a no bond finding without the district attorney's office filing either an 11A, B, or C motion. And so when you see these, what I've been telling people for the last year is you got to stop saying, I can't believe the judge did that, because right. they can't do it by themselves. You got to start saying, I can't believe the DA's office didn't file an 11B motion and put on just a small part of the new crime, because at that point, then the judge can hold them at no bond. But I truly believe in my heart of hearts that if you commit a crime, right, and we're going to remove murders, sex assault of a child, ag robs, because those, I think you have inherently said you're likely to be a future danger to the community. But everything else, if you're not likely to be a future danger to the community while you're on bond or a flight risk, or you can minimize those threats by some type of pretrial condition, I don't care what's in your bank account. I mean, I don't care if you flew in on a jet or you spent last night under I-10. It should not factor in on whether you get out.
Yeah.
Once you have committed a crime while you're out on bond, you've answered yes to my first question, period, full stop, right? You are a continuing threat to the community, and we hold you in custody. But where everybody starts to fall down on that is it all sounds great at first, but if we're taking 2.5-3 years to try a UUMV case, that's tough to justify holding somebody pre-conviction 3.5 years in custody when we're paying $50 million to bus people to Louisiana and Arkansas and West Texas because our jail's so dang
Just cool. the county jail?
Just the county, county jail.
Oh, God.
So what we've got to do is you got to fix it all together. We've got to get down, and I think it's by waiving jury trials on these little ones and doing court trials over and over and over. I can do 10 of them a week. My officers get to learn how to testify. My young prosecutors get to learn how to
How to be in evidence, court.
How to actually do this. We see the numbers plummet because all you want to do is send them where they need to go. The county jail should be nothing but a holding cell for where they need to go, be it probation, be it a dismissal, be it TDC or state jail, whatever it is. That's where we got to get them. And once we get that down to a reasonable time frame, you're going to see a lot less angst in holding people in custody pre-conviction because the time frame is shorter.
Yeah.
And so I think that's the way that we can get to the point where we're not seeing this. And regardless, you're not going to see 14 bonds and somebody get out. It's just we're going to create a group within the office whose job is to go do 11B motions, right? Whose job is to evaluate whether an 11A motion is the appropriate avenue to go down and do this. Because what you're seeing is a lot of these judges, they don't want violent criminals walking out. But because we're not doing the 11Bs or doing them well, they're giving a high number. And then over the course of a year, 2 years, they just keep whittling down the cash number to the point where they can get out again. That shouldn't be what bond is, right? Mm-hmm. Because then it becomes punitive. It's if we can just winnow it down to this number, I can get out. It's not going to ensure that they come back to court. Right. It's not going to ensure that they don't commit a new crime. So if I had my druthers, we would get cashless out of it. We would get cash out of the words for bond.
You did say that you wanted to get rid of the cash bonds and so forth. And you said three I know regarding three cases, or excuse me, crimes, harassment, assault, causing bodily injury, and criminal mischief. Mm-hmm. I can see harassment and criminal mischief to an extent. Explain to how regarding assault and bodily injury, especially when it comes to a victim of domestic violence.
So I think when you're talking about especially assault family members, stalking, harassment, all of these kind of cases, right? There is no amount of money that I can get on an assault family member, especially a Class A, that's going to ensure that that person's safe. $0. Like, it can be zero, it can be $5,000, which is the most we can get on a first time, right? Those people are going to make that bond.
Yep.
So what we should be doing is an 11A, give me 60 days of no bond. You just sit, right? I can't do an 11B on them, but I can do 11A. And during those 60 days, you ensure that the alleged victim has a safe place to be, has some resources that are going to ensure that that person isn't going to be victimized again while you're pending this case, right? That is the only way that I know of that we can ensure those people.
But wouldn't that lengthen the jail's population, or at least boast it by doing that? Or depending, I guess the case dependent.
It's case dependent, but if I'm doing that, right, but I'm also PR bonding the first time UUMBs and the Berg buildings and the PCSs and all the other things to get them out of jail.
Right.
Now we got a heck of a lot more room. And if I've waived jury trials, I don't have people sitting for 3.5-4 years. So the jail is set and can handle 10,000 people. The problem is we've got the same 8,000 in there for 4 years.
Right.
At that point, you're talking about a 2,000 person population.
Yeah.
Before we have to bust them.
Question on the PCS, because we talked about that again back in August about, you know, 4 grams. Say I got 4 grams caught on me for fentanyl, which, you know, what does that kill? 500,000 people technically, sure, and so forth. Diversion? No diversion. And then are you going to accept the charges without having the lab results?
Yeah, the lab results are.
Yeah.
Come on, because you know where we are with that right now, yeah, right? So help me out. So,
all right.
Give me an answer.
So the way that I want to view that is, I think at least in the short term, fentanyl is in a class by itself, right? I don't want to get to the position where we were in the 80s with crack, where you got people that are doing 35 years for crack that now we just, you know, throw away. But fentanyl right now, both the public and the people are dying and they're scared. So that's a different officers animal. I carry Narcan every scene I've ever made,
yes,
right, for that reason. So I think fentanyl is in a different category, and I don't think we divert those. I think we bring those in and figure out what we're doing, right? But the other kind of dope, I want to have, I think there have been models around the country that have these community courts, right? And I don't know what it looks like here, but I think there is a way for us to go look at it where you don't take them to the JPC. They get taken, and because you never know if some of them have fentanyl or something, I don't think we as law enforcement can just let them go, right, for their own safety. So you got to take them, but where you take them is different. And I think if we take them to these community courts, which is a more localized, targeted diversion programs that's staffed with mental health and addiction specialists, in addition to prosecutors and judges, they set up those diversion programs in that location. They're also partnered. You have representatives from the unions there. You have representatives from the JUCOs that are on site with those people. You're going to save a few of them. You're going to give a different avenue for the possession cases. And quite frankly, it's going to help get officers back on the street in a lot faster deal. We're tagging this, right? We're just tagging the dope. That person is dropped off here, not all the way down JPC. And that officer's back on the street. I think in some way we can do that pretty quickly to figure out if it works. But unlike my predecessor, we're not going to do these things without getting input from the agencies that get involved.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, in my mind, it makes sense. Like when we do no refusal offsite locations, it's so I can get warrants done, process the defendants, and get that officer back on the street. I think there's some model that we can do like that, but I'm not the expert in that. And so we're going to figure out in collaboration whether or not that's something that's viable. Because again, just like retail theft, I don't think most officers care where they drop that defendant off, right? They want to make sure that the person's off the street, that's not sitting on the corner so that the grandma who lives right behind them has to deal with that for the rest of her life. And then you got to hear about it every time you drive past the street. If we're doing something different with them, I think it's fine as long as it is in a collaborative way and it's beneficial to everybody.
Just a little bit ago, Clint was bringing up Travis County and the illustrious Jose Garza, which is, you know, that's a whole other story by itself. But one of the main problems that we see, not just in Texas, not just in Travis County, but across America, are these quote unquote Uncle George Soros funded district attorneys.
64 minutes, guys. I'm so disappointed.
Hey, yeah, it took us a while to get there, but we kind of had a little.
Just let me clarify that.
Yeah, you know, one of the things I'll be straightforward. When news came about that you know, Kim Ogg had lost, that you had beat her in the election, I was very excited, and I made a post, and I kind of got some Facebook messages and Instagram messages of saying, are people worried and concerned that, you know, you were number one Soros funded, and that there's some rumors about what they say that they were, you were going to be more radical,
more liberal
than left, yeah. You know, Kim Ogg. So,
and there's a belief that if you take a dollar from Soros, you are beholden to his instructions.
Yeah. What does he get in return? That's the question of every officer, right? And everyone regarding it. And when you take Soros' money, what is he promised? What does he get in return? Because we talked about this, you know, pre-show regarding across the country, these large cities across the LAs, the New Yorks, the Oakland's, Harris County, Oakland's, all fund DAs from George Soros' camp, right? Mm-hmm. All radical DAs, highest crime rates across the country, failing economies. We could go on and on. All George Soros funded individuals. How are you going to be different from everyone else here in Harris County?
Did he give Kim Ogg money last time?
No. He gave her money in 16.
Yes.
16, so the first time. Mm-hmm. So he stopped and provided your campaign this time.
Yep.
What made him change? Do you know?
I don't know. And
how much did you give, by the way? Just curious. For the record.
God, I think it was 1.6 million, somewhere in that neighborhood.
Which for the listener and viewer out there, politics in Harris County, again, the third largest county in Texas.
Yes.
There's a lot of things that, you know, cost in a campaign. So, I mean, that sounds like a very large number, and it is. But your total campaign cost?
I think we spent north of $4 million.
Okay.
I raised over $4 million.
Okay.
And so, look, it is, I have friends who are right-wing Republicans. It always has.
He slid his head over.
I just did it toward the middle of the table. But it's always made me laugh. And now actually meeting with, you know, I've never met Mr. Soros. I seriously doubt that I will ever meet Mr. Soros. But meeting with them has just reinforced. He has become a boogeyman for the right that is really undeserved in a lot of ways. When you look at the amount of billionaires for Democrats versus Republicans, the Republicans dump with their billionaire people all over the place, a lot more than Mr. Soros ever has.
But Sean, I gotta interject this because you know me. I'm not shy at saying it. But the fact of the matter is that might be true. However, their mission is not to destroy America.
Well, and the unique thing is
I have to say that for the record.
I can promise you that two things. I can promise you that there are no strings attached to the money. And I know a number of the prosecutors in different jurisdictions who have gotten support from that group. It doesn't come with any strings. Before they decide whether or not they're going to support someone, they listen to the whole platform, right? And they listened to the exact same platform that you and I've talked about a number of times. And they decided to get in on this race strictly because of that.
Is his views more of like a community approach with the criminal justice reform? Is that essentially what you know, he's trying to kind of evolve into? Is that why he's tapped in? Because my, you know, me being a Texan, I question why how he's an older, you know, Californian guy would have
huh? New York.
Well, he lives in California too. The dude's got property everywhere, right? But yeah. Why he would give two shits about what's going on in Harris County, Texas, with the politics? And that's what's concerning to me, because we say it all the time, is that we welcome. I'll say it on record. We absolutely welcome anybody that comes from anywhere, as long as it's legal, to transition into Texas. But don't move here because Texas is awesome the way it is and bring bullshit politics with it to make it to where you came from.
Absolutely agree.
Well, I think the bad rap he got is everywhere he inserts himself, those communities are all kind of on fire in a shithole.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it's a coincidence, but wherever he seems to insert himself usually goes down the drain.
Well, when you look at it, he is – that group is very intentional about the places that they go. It's where they're going to get the most effect, right? I mean, you're talking about Harris County. We're the third largest county, not in Texas.
Well, it's the electorals. That's the issue. Let's clarify that. It's the electorals. He's going to the areas, the most populated areas, that have the most influence in legislation in state and federal. That's a fact. He's not going to give me a small
little Marshall, like, Texas.
Yeah, exactly. He's not going to.
Well, if he controls Dallas County, Harris County, absolute, Travis
he
County.
He controls Texas.
He pretty much controls.
Absolutely. And that's exactly the standpoint.
I got to tell you, I've had this conversation with guys I've grown up with over and over over beers. He is not the boogeyman that anyone thinks. He truly has, that group has a vision of what criminal justice reform can look like. And he doesn't typically, that group doesn't typically jump into other types of politics. He's really passionate about the stuff that we're talking about.
Right? But Sean, I got a question on that. If he is so passionate about it, why is he going to the DAs? Why has he never approached law enforcement itself? The ones that are actually on the front lines doing it day in and day out. Not DAs, because I'm not saying all DAs stand behind desks and so forth, but the majority of them do.
Sure.
Fact. And so if he's so, you know, involved in community
Policing,
exactly.
Or criminal justice reform.
Exactly, reform. Then why is he going to the front lines and speaking to any of them? Why is it only the ones that make the change in the law or dictate how the law is ran?
I don't know the answer to that. I just know that.
But you can see that we have to convince our listeners, our fellow officers, the reason why.
Well, obviously, when you talk about the way that people like Mr. Soros, that people like the Dunns, right? The Dunn brothers, people on both sides of the aisle, the way they can affect change is by giving money to like-minded people. Right? And so that is his path. And so I don't think typically, other than sheriffs, you don't have frontline law enforcement agencies that are elected. Like they are appointed typically, and so the way that you can affect the most change in the criminal justice space is by the DA's office in elections. And so I think that's what you're seeing. But at the end of the day, the bottom line is I'm not changing my vision for how we can make Harris County work and be equitable and be safe for everyone. For anybody. I'm not changing it for you three and TMBA. I'm not changing it for the Soros groups. I'm not changing it for Texas Organizing Project. I'm not changing it for Working Families Parties. I'm not changing it for anything. I've been in this long enough. I think I have a pretty good plan going forward, and I promise you I'm going to screw it up a number of times and in a number of ways. But the one thing that I can promise you is I'm not owned by any one group, but I will listen to and talk to everyone and figure out how we can do this the right way. Yep. And so when I screw up, I'll come right back here in this wonderful big room and we'll talk about it and you can tell me and we'll figure it out. And then we're going down the line, right? Yep. And I will sit there and I will field phone calls from the Houston Ministers Against Crime. I'll listen to Texas Organizing Project. We're going to talk about all of it. And at the end of the day, I'm going to do what I think is the right thing. But at every step, there are a lot of people that are going
to
have input.
You know, one of the things that that you've we've talked about is things that you can improve, and we look forward to you improving. You being a prosecutor for so many years and seeing the good, bad, the ugly, what can cops do? For anybody listening to this podcast, watching this show, you know, what can law enforcement do besides this and besides having the meetings and the communications? But what can, you know, the 26-year-old patrolman in Mansfield, Texas, or the 32-year-old cop in Pearland right now, what can we do better on our end to strengthen not only the cases, but strengthen the relationships between the DA's office, you know, maybe not having an attitude when they are on hold.
Yeah.
Small things like that.
You pointed it.
Yeah, because y'all don't have to be on hold. He still has to be
I didn't
on
mean
hold.
It that way. I'm sorry, bro.
His call
bro.
Is God. Still important to
yeah, his call is still, he hasn't pressed three. But, yeah, but. You know, but
I can clarify. I'm just busting my balls.
I did not bust your balls. Sorry.
Prior to this podcast, I think I've been very calm.
You have. No, I am absolutely proud. I said on record, I'm very proud of Brian Lithcomb for holding it together. Sometimes his passion is misconstrued as anger.
That, yeah. Thank you.
So,
thank you for clarifying that.
I didn't think two gummies would work.
But no testing, no testing.
Yeah. But yeah, so I mean, what can law enforcement do on our end to improve the quality of service or the quality of work with and strengthen relationships with DA's offices?
That's such a good question, you know, because it does have to come both ways. I really think just like my young prosecutors need to go out on just ride-alongs, but they need to go out to scenes and see the kind of stuff that they're asking these officers to do. I think we need to have more collaboration and more interaction with the officers coming into court, sitting through a docket. I'm going to encourage that from every agency. Come sit in the docket, put on a suit. I know how much it hurts y'all, but put on a suit. We'll sit you up front and you just listen to the negotiations and the back and forth. See what that looks like. Sit in with a prosecutor, even on a DWI, on an assault family member, not just with your witness meeting. Sit with them as they prepare for that trial. Understand the stress on this end about standing up in front of 65 people and picking a jury and then going forward and cross-examining and fighting defense attorneys and fighting with judges. Get what that's like, too. And you're never going to get it fully, just like we're never going to get what it feels like to approach a car at 12:30 at night on, you know, the side of a dark road. Like I've never felt that terror, and I don't know what I would do, but I at least understand that it exists.
Yeah.
And so I think on the officer's side, especially the 26-year-old patrol guy, come in. Like the next time you get subpoenaed to a case, call the prosecutor and just say, hey, can I come early? Can I just sit and talk with you? Get to know a couple of the prosecutors you work with. Because at the end of the day, not only are we all just human and live in the same communities, we all share a vision of criminal justice safety, right? Whether you're a reformer or not, we all want to do the right thing, whatever we think that is. And as long as you get that and start from that position, I really think we ain't that different.
But it also goes back to relationships.
Communication.
And if you build a relationship and you have communication, you end up building trust that's completely gone.
Yeah.
But I like that idea because, you know, if you get in a year and you see, man, their intox manslaughter cases are kind of not great out in Pearland and Pasadena, send a prosecutor out there during in-service and go, hey, I don't want to have to kick these back. So let me share some of the things I'm seeing of how can you build a better intox manslaughter case?
Absolutely. And I think there's a great opportunity for that to go out, especially for these young troops in the academies.
Yes.
Go bring in a prosecutor. Let them know. Just give them – because, I mean, we go through the penal code, right, through when you're going through the academy, get your TCOL license, et cetera, and so forth. So you're learning the law. Yeah. Why not have a prosecutor pop in every once in a while to these academies and explain, hey, this is what – because they're going to know, obviously, more than that officer at that point in time because they're fresh, right? They haven't even been on the streets.
Yep.
But give them an idea of what you're looking for so they know prior to going out there to make sure. So why not start at ground zero?
So the last 7 years that I was at the office, I taught every cadet class at HPD penal code and courtroom demeanor.
Wow.
Every class. And it's just it's great, you know, when I get popped for speeding now because I've taught that person. But
if you speed,
but you don't. Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah, hypothetical, yes, I don't speed at all. But it's just building those relationships. It's making them feel comfortable in a different setting than what they do every day. And I think it's got to go both ways. And you're exactly right. It's just got to be the trust. And so what I want to do when I come in is start absolutely in all of the academies, but also those first, second, third year officers.
Yes.
I want to bring them in and have mock trials and sit around and teach them how to testify, because in That's the huge. Vast majority yes, yes. of my trials in the DA's office as a whole, the only expert you got is the officer, right? He is the expert. She is the expert that is supposed to be testifying about this.
That's correct.
And when you look at real experts, or you look at homicide detectives or things like that, they know how to testify, right? I mean, they look at the person questioning them, and they turn and talk to the jury, and you're just like, God, right. thank you for that. And so if we have young officers that understand that, the quality of our cases are going to get better. We're going to win more cases we should win. And we're going to build that rapport.
So well, and in return, it makes a safer community.
Absolutely correct.
But it's easy for us to lie. And I'll say it again. Kudos to you for stepping up here and coming over here and getting on the podcast, because it just shows your commitment. It shows that you're open to have a conversation. But it's really easy, and cops are bad at it, to pull that pin out, throw these grenades. Yep. But then not say
flashbangs.
Well, flashbangs.
Yeah, we're not really.
But what can we do better? What can we do better on our end? How can we prepare this case better to prepare a winning case for you guys? Because that's the reality. We're essentially, if it's a football team, we're handing you the ball Absolutely. To score the touchdown.
I mean, good look, point. Dick Wolf, who is an amazing guy that created Law and Order. I mean, the first thing he ever said on that show is, "They're two separate but equal parts." Right, the police. Who arrests the offenders, and the prosecutors who prosecute.
I thought it was these stories are not based on actual events.
Well, except they all were. Yeah. No, they really are separate but equal entities. Yeah. And unless you really understand that, you're not gonna do anything.
So one question our listeners are going to be mad if we don't ask. We have a lot of conservative listeners.
No.
And they think anybody with a D after their name is Bernie Sanders. What's your opinion on the death penalty?
So this is the question that I have gotten asked a lot. And look, historically, in the state of Texas and in the United States, the death penalty has been so overused. It has been disproportionately used against black and brown people and poor people. And I think that there is a 0% chance that we have executed an innocent person in this country. I think it's a travesty. And I think if there was a real other alternative, and I personally think it would be life without parole in solitary confinement, that doesn't exist. So as it sits right now, there are people who there is no safe place for in this community, in any lockup, in any way, shape, or form, other than the death penalty. I think that percentage is extraordinarily small. I think it should be reserved for the absolute worst of the worst, most dangerous future danger people that we've ever seen. And I think we have to almost have a higher burden of proof in our own mind beyond a reasonable doubt. It needs to be just about beyond all doubt. All of that being said, there are people. I have been in this job long enough. Pure evil exists.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
And there are people that I believe the death penalty is appropriate.
Okay.
I can live with that.
Well, I'm good. I'm glad,
Brian. I mean, dude, if Brian can live with it, I'm just leaving now while I'm ahead.
Yeah, that's a pretty high bar to hit.
Yeah. Well, Brian, did you got everything on your list that we touched base on?
You know what? Checklist? We bounced all around. I was trying to go on, you know, my order, but, you know.
Oh, no, this show is not about order.
That you ain't lying. It's not. So.
And, boys, I do want to tell y'all that this won't be the last time you have me on here.
It's awesome.
So you can absolutely keep the list longer and longer. I feel like you and I are going to have conversations outside of this podcast.
Yes, we are.
But I want everyone listening to know that I love what you guys do. I love and respect the hell out of every sworn officer on the planet. especially in my communities. I am always going to be here to answer questions. I'll do it on this podcast. I'll do it over the phone. Whatever y'all need, I'm always going to be available to talk.
And I respect the hell out of that, because one of the problems in our country right now is if you have an R or a D, then we, if you don't agree with me, then you're wrong. And we can't even be friends, and our kids can't run around together, and you're the, you're Satan. And for you to come on and not know what we may ask or not ask, just man to man, I respect the hell out of that. Because it takes some intestinal fortitude to be like, screw it, I'll show up and stand before them. But you said it offline earlier. We're not always going to get along. But we can sure cuss, discuss, argue, fight, and then we'll go have a beer together.
Yeah, man.
I respect the heck out of that, because if we can't, if everybody in the world agreed, there's a problem, and there would be no advancement. But we ought to be able to duke it out, and then let's go figure out, and it wasn't personal, and let's go break.
Well, and the mindset is that because you do have a D next to your name, is that you're scared to recognize and say, I support law enforcement.
100%.
I support law enforcement. And the fact that you're not scared to, man, you've got my full support, and I appreciate the hell out of it. Yeah, just like Clint said. So.
You know, and a huge thing for us is when we called him back in August, we were the first ones he met with, I believe, correct?
You were.
And, I mean, we're not a small agency, but we're a mid-sized agency, but we're not HPD, and we're darn sure not the sheriff's office, right? But he was the first ones we called Sean, the first ones, you know, or he came out and we were, you know, to be the first ones. It's impressive. And he's never not answered. He, you know, we gave him the TMPA's number. Here he is. So kudos for that. I really do appreciate it. And I hope we definitely have more conversations in the future.
Appreciate you coming on, man.
We will. This was fun.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I got some questions I like asking. In your career of doing this, what's your best day and what's your worst day?
Best day. I think the best day that I ever had was, there's so many grounds. I think the best day I ever had was the last trial I tried before I left to run. I knew it was going to be my last trial. I'd gotten very, very close with the victim's family. It was a felony murder. And I knew no matter how this election turned out, this was the last time I was ever going to be a rank and file prosecutor. I was ever going to actually get to speak as just an ADA, just somebody that was there. And this case had pinned for, God, since February of 18, and I tried it in November of 22. And so, you know, during all that time, I was at the scene when it happened. And I got to take it all the way to the end. And so they came back with a guilty and multiple decades in prison. And getting to hug the wife and the three kids in the courtroom right after, and knowing that that was it for me.
That's the closest to closure they're going to get, and a little closure for you, I guess.
Absolutely. Just all the way through. It was really a full circle moment for me, you know, and in that day, I started thinking about, as an intern, trying my first DWI, I think, God, this is the coolest job in the world. And then getting to recognize that it was the coolest job in the world that many years later. And then that widow introduced me at my my launch party, and just having those kind of moments. So I think that was my best day as a prosecutor.
I think it's awesome, because you had faith in the system.
Yeah, it worked.
And that's fantastic.
It was long, but it worked. Yeah. You know, we had COVID during that time too. But the worst day that I ever had as a prosecutor was turning in my badge. Just that, because again, I always had intentions of coming back to lead the office, but trust me when I tell you, February of 23, that was unknown whether that was going to happen.
Yeah.
And taking that leap of faith and giving up the job that I quite frankly believe I was born to have, which is advocating for what's right in every case. That was the hardest day of my job, my life professionally, giving, you know, just driving home by myself. And I yeah, it still kind of chokes me up thinking about it. And now thinking that I get to come back is...
How old are you?
44.
Damn kid.
What would 44-year-old Sean tell 14-year-old Sean?
Don't throw as many pitches. Because two rotator cuff surgeries later, I might not be here.
Yeah. Yep. All right.
And that was fun.
Well, we like to end this. Since you're not in law enforcement, you can jump in here if you want to. But Brian?
Yes, sir.
What's your favorite cop movie or line from a cop movie? What's your favorite cop car and your favorite drink of choice?
Well, I'm definitely jumping in on this.
My favorite cop movie. Oh, my gosh. Training Day.
That's a good one.
That's a good one. Denzel.
Fantastic. Favorite car by far. I don't care what they say. Crown Vic's the best damn police car ever walked the earth or drove on this earth. The fact that Ford got rid of it, go to hell with them. So that's just a fact.
You said Crown Vic?
Crown Vic, okay. By far. Right. And best drink, you know what? I'm a simple guy. I like a nice cold beer.
There you go. John?
All right. Best cop movies and to watch.
Yes.
Yes.
Just,
it's a great movie.
I watched it again the other day. I love the fact that they call it a shot.
I didn't think of that. You got me on that. That's a good one.
Yeah, that's a good
one. Still like Training Day, though.
Yeah, oh, dude. I mean, come on. Yeah. It's, again, Denzel.
Yeah,
exactly.
And then.
Cop car.
Oh, dude. See, for me, because I like space, Tahoe, put the gun safe in the back and everything. Yeah. That's, by the way. When I come back, that's going to be the car I drive.
Let me clarify. Yeah. Have you ever drove a Crown Vic?
Yeah.
I mean, you can't kill a Crown Vic. You understand
that. At the DA's office, when your car went in to the shop, the DA's office has like six old Crown Vics that they've just pulled out the
because they last.
And they last.
See that? Clarify that?
They last. Dude, you got the police interceptor engine
and war wagon.
No shocks. And so you just go, my God.
Yep. War wagon for sure.
Still goes.
I mean, it still goes.
Still goes.
You know, I'm a man of finer taste. So
you know, just like our Chevy Tahoes that we currently keep buying. And the great thing is you got to add, you know, every time you fill up, you got to check the oil because they burn oil like a soul. So, I mean, so that's the kind of things that we want to continue to spend money on. Absolutely. Cop cars that continue to burn oil. Best cop car ever built was a Ford. We're going to get rid of that.
Well, the reason they got rid of Crown Vics is because they were built Ford tough.
That's exactly right. Amen.
Yeah. What's your favorite drink of choice?
Drink of choice. Irish whiskey.
That's a good one.
Black Bush. And I know it's from Northern Ireland, but it's Bushmills. Like, nice.
Need to run a rock.
One rock.
That's my man.
Maybe we'll have that as a celebration drink in November.
There you go.
I love that.
At the celebration night.
Sounds great.
Yeah. Well, that's about wraps this up. You got anything else, big dog?
No, I sincerely appreciate you coming on. And I think it's important for people to hear, because there's a lot of assumptions made when you hear that guy's a Democrat or there's a whole lot of labels that fly around.
Yeah.
And I appreciate somebody being, having the integrity to, I'll stand up and answer for whatever, fire away. Because before we came on, they were joking around about what we were going to ask, and you're like, fire away. I'll be upset if you don't ask the hard question.
There are no off limits questions, especially when you're talking about something as important as the DA's office.
Yep.
I think that everybody should be able to ask every question possible before you make a decision on who's going to be the DA.
Hey, Nat, hit that camera towards me and Brian. Hey, Jose Garza. Sean Tier is what courage looks like. I want to take a few pages out of this man's book. And we hope you can come on too and explain yourself just like he did.
Can't agree more.
Yours truly. I appreciate it. All right. That's it. That's all I wanted to say.
I got to say, Sean, I got to give you credit, because I know when we first met, you knew where I stood on the aisle by all means. And I'm not going to change for who I am. I'm a very conservative person. The fact of the matter is, you coming out here and doing this, and then just not only meeting with us prior to, kudos to you, man. Really appreciate it.
I loved it, boys.
Yeah. You
wanna do it again?
Appreciate it. You guys take care. Stay safe. Hit that subscribe button. Man, we got some upcoming stuff coming up. Texas Peace Officer Memorial, Texas FOP Spring Board Meeting, and the TMPA's annual conference joint with FOP. Yep. Sean, open invitation, July 26th to the 28th.
Might have a speaker.
Yeah, it'd be pretty good to have. There's 700 cops. You'd feel safe. A few cocktails, maybe some Irish whiskey. Be a good time.
You're on.
Yeah, let's do it. You guys take care, stay safe. God bless you, and as always, may God bless Texas.
Amen.